we've really made a concerted effort to make failure acceptable, that we can try things and we don't have to be perfect.
We rightly celebrate the struggles of startups and their brave founders, but it can be tough working in a bigger company too, where powerful corporate antibodies seek and destroy new ideas that don't conform to the conventional culture. But some leaders battle the status quo inside their own companies to innovate and drive change. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and this is their story.
I'm Jill Castilla, President and CEO of Citizens Bank of Edmond in Edmond, Oklahoma. We're a $250 million bank with one location, and we've been around for 116 years on the same intersection. Edmond is a suburb of Oklahoma City.
So Jill, you're a part of a fourth generation banking family, but you didn't start in banking throughout your whole career. Tell us a little bit about your background.
I grew up in eastern Oklahoma with a single dad. He was a probation parole officer. We were a pretty poor family. The local community banker in town really took me under her wing, as she did lots of youngsters with promise in our community, and encouraged me to go to college. It wasn't something that my family had planned for me, but she really pushed me every time she would see me, whether I was waitressing for her at the local country club, or if I was carrying your groceries out at the local grocery store, she would always prod me about going to college. So I applied and wasn't able to even have family support to apply for financial aid. So I had to work at a grocery store while I went to school to try to make ends meet. And after my sophomore year in college, I was a chemical engineering major and was carrying groceries out and kind of on my last leg emotionally and financially, and where I was working all night at the grocery store and then going to class all day and then trying to be involved on campus. Did really well academically, but just kind of was running out of resources. And an Army recruiter happened to be the person I was carrying groceries out for at 2 o'clock in the morning. And he asked me why I was working so late. And I said, I was trying to pay for college. And he said, well, the Army will pay for all this. You can be an independent student, apply for financial aid, get the GI Bill. You know, after you complete your enlistment, you can apply for ROTC scholarships. And it was like the heavens opened up and I had a way to go to college. So I enlisted in the Army the next day, was on active duty for a couple of years. I was a civil engineer ultimately, but I started out as a construction surveyor, a draftsman, and soil analyst, and then went to college, ended up meeting my husband there, spent another 2 years as a chemical engineering major, and then he got stationed in Hawaii, where I started school all over again, and actually was at working in a t-shirt shop in Hawaii. And my boss there said I should consider getting a degree in business, and I could always go back to engineering. I was having some trouble with my credits all transferring appropriately. So I went down to the street to the local kind of private university there in Hawaii, and they took my differential equations class and gave me like accounting 101 and linear algebra and gave me basic finance and were really lenient with me with my transferring into the finance degree program. And I took 33 credit hours a semester while I worked full time and got my degree in a year. Really kind of fell in love with finance and started seeing how I could be challenged analytically, and came back to Oklahoma. And during this time, my mom married into the family that owns Citizens Bank of Edmond. And I came to work at the bank for minimum wage in the bookkeeping department. And it was right when hotjobs.com and monster.com came out, where you could apply for jobs online. And I found my dream job that was recruiting at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. They had a management development program where you manage different areas of the Fed and to develop their future leadership. And they hired me, which was extraordinary at that time to think that they would. And had a 10-year run at the Fed. They paid for me to get my master's degree in economics and exposed me to, you know, everything that the Federal Reserve does, as well as how important community banking is. And, you know, we go around the district and interview community bankers and trying to figure out how we could support them better, but then you could see the impact they make in their community. The Fed sent me to the Graduate School of Banking and there in Wisconsin. And there I got to kind of work alongside community bankers. And those 3 years of that program, I just fell in love with community banking again. I got to be inspired by the lady that took me underneath her wing that many years ago, back in a little small town, and knowing what a community banker does from a social impact in the community. But then I also got to see the intellectual rigor of being a community banker. And while you have these rules to abide by, there's great impact that you can make, both socially and economically, to the community that you're serving, and there's a lot of creativity that can be infused there. So one of my classmates recruited me to come up to his family's bank in northern Minnesota as his chief financial officer. And I was up there for a couple of years, and I'd hoped that one day I could come back, kind of prove my worth and come back to Edmond and work at Citizens Bank of Edmond in a more responsible position than when I was in before. And the same bank I was at in northern Minnesota was the same size bank as Citizens, also family ran, four generations who I was working for. And I'd hoped to work in Minnesota for about 5 years. And then prove my worth and come back home to Edmond, Oklahoma. I got a call from my stepdad, though, about 2 years into my run. And he said that the bank had had a terrible examination and that he needed my help. He was concerned that they would lose the ownership of the bank. The bank is owned a third by employees and a third by through an ESOP and a third by a family, his family. And he was concerned that they would ultimately have to sell the bank because of the condition that they had fallen into. And the economy in Oklahoma at that time was strong, but this bank had grown without really getting the systems in place to be able to have segregation duties and structures and such that supported growth and construction lending and commercial real estate and type of lending. It was a rapid decline. They had already massive charge-offs. So he asked me to come back. He was serving in the chairman's role, and the president at the time offered me the job, and it was a 50% pay cut. It was moving from being the lead financial position at the bank I was in and being on the senior management team to moving to assistant treasurer position with really no authority. And I initially went to my husband, and my husband, who's following me around through my career, said, hell no, you're not going and taking this huge pay cut. And at that time, I really kind of thought, well, maybe I'm just not worth that. Maybe this is maybe half my pay is really what I'm worth. But he stood up for me and said no. And so I said no. And my stepdad flew up to Minnesota and said he really needed me and that he was going to lose the bank and he couldn't do anything about the financial situation. So we were in a hotel room with my husband and my parents, and my husband looked at me and he's like, I guess we're going to Oklahoma. So he stayed up in northern Minnesota, and I took the three kids and moved in with my mom and my stepdad because we couldn't afford to support multiple households, and started working at Citizens Bank in that assistant treasurer role.
Well, that doesn't sound like a great deal at all. Why did you say yes to this?
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah. And at the time, it wasn't a great career move. And that wasn't, I'd always been so ambitious and trying to prove myself and work up the professional ladder. This really was the first time someone had ever reached out to me and said that they really needed me. And, I had real turbulent childhood growing up, and had always kind of had to work to get to college and work to get through college and work to get the position at the Fed and get through that. And this is the first time where someone had really reached out to me and said that I was really the person that they needed to save something. And it was really tugged at me emotionally, and to be part of a legacy and saving something like a community bank that's been the cornerstone of Edmond, Oklahoma since its very beginning. It was really a romantic type of choice versus something that was about a career. And it proved, I doubted that decision a lot early on, but looking back, it was an extraordinary intersection in my life that I think really changed the course of where I was going professionally, as well as kind of where this bank could go.
So how bad was it?
So they were not the bottom of the Camel's rating, but they were as close to the bottom as you can get. They thought that they just needed to put away a few million dollars in a loan loss reserve. But within 30 days, I found several million dollars of internal fraud from expense abuse. And then it was a regular occurrence where a loan officer would tell me that they had a beautifully built $2 million spec house that was ready to be sold. And they didn't know why it wasn't being sold yet, but this builder just needed a little bit more time. And I would drive by the lot, and it would be an empty lot. And we would argue in committee about the loan officer saying, no, that there's this beautiful, the idiot that can't find it in the neighborhood. And I would drive by it 100 times and just see this empty lot, and we would get it back and there would be nothing there. There wouldn't be a house there. And that happened dozens of times. And then we had abuse internally where you couldn't trust the documents that were coming out of the bank, the financial statements. We had overstated capital by $2 million, and we were very light on capital. and had just had capital audited, the capital account had just been audited. And when I reviewed it, it looked to me like there was some funny business going on. And I re-audited and found that it was overstated, and then had the auditor, external auditors re-audit it, and they confirmed. So it was, the financial statements can be trusted. The lenders at the time couldn't be trusted to be truthful. Staff was very intimidated by the officers of the bank and would do anything that they said. Whereas the stock value for the employee stock ownership program lost 90% of its value in 1 year. So everyone's 401ks plummeted. And we had $12 million of losses and loans in that first year, and we only had $30 million of capital to begin with. So it was, you know, a bank losing a third of its capital, 90% of its value, morale that was destroyed. The bank has 6 branch locations that were all within 2 miles of one another, all of which were hemorrhaging losses. A community that loved the previous management that was there. And when that was lost, when there was turnover that occurred, a huge stigma associated with me during that time. So I would go into restaurants, or I would go in to get my haircuts, for example, the very first time across the street from the bank, and the lady cutting my hair asked why I moved to Edmond. I said, to work at Citizens. And she said, well, you need to be careful because there's a woman there that's evil. And I said, well, I think that I'm that woman. And she said, no, you're sweet. And I said, no, I think that's me. And then 3 months later, I went and got my hair cut across town, and the same thing happened again. It was a regular occurrence where I would go to Chamber of Commerce get-togethers and extend my hand and introduce myself to someone, and they would throw their hands up and back away and say, I know who you are, and would disengage from a conversation. So, you know, people would come in with their bankrate.com printout of our bank's rating, and it was frequently a D minus or a D, and want an explanation as to why the bank was in this condition. And so we were trying to orchestrate that recovery while we had eroding social capital, as well as a balance sheet and a loan portfolio that were untrustworthy.
So was this worse than you thought?
Oh, definitely. I came back thinking these were all individuals I worked with 15 years before when I was working in the bookkeeping department. I kind of grown up around them while I was at the Fed even. So they were all characters that I knew and really loved and respected. And when I walked in, no one would talk to me. They would not respond to emails. I thought I was walking into kind of joining the gang and recovering the bank and kind of getting the ship into shape. And what I found, though, was that no one really would acknowledge the trouble the bank was in and did more work kind of covering it up rather than trying to fix it. Luckily, when I worked in the bookkeeping department, the supervisor of the bookkeeping department was now the chief operations officer, and she knew me well, and she was my first person that would kind of align with me and help me research and allow me to start gaining some momentum and converting people from being kind of in a denial situation to one in which we were all grabbing a bucket and trying to get the water out of the boat.
Well, how did you not throw in the towel at this point? This was a really bad deal. You're living apart from your family, and things just get worse. Everything you dig into deeper.
And I was lucky because my boss at the bank I was at previously told me that he was holding the position open for me. He was worried about me taking the role, especially this is mid-2009, so bank failures were occurring around the nation, and so I wasn't looking very positive. So I knew I had that support. I also knew my husband, who is incredibly and supportive, would say, if this doesn't work out, you can do whatever you need to do. I think it hit me the hardest whenever you're walking into a troubled bank as an officer. You have to sign a lot of things acknowledging that it's a troubled bank and you're getting fingerprinted. And, it's different from going into another type of bank situation. And there's a lot of disclosures about if you do something wrong, you may never work in banking again. And so I think initially I was driven a lot by fear, wanting to see that these individuals were reliant upon this bank for their retirement, seeing and knowing how much a community relies on the real kind of community bank in town, the one that's providing not only the donations to the nonprofit nonprofits, but the sweat equity into the community, knowing what that community banker meant to me as a youngster. I knew that we meant that to a lot of the population in Edmond. A lot of it was driven by fear initially of not wanting something to fail, not wanting to fail myself, not wanting to embarrass my family and my stepfather's family, and fighting for this legacy and hoping that we could come out on the other side better for it.
So things keep getting worse. You find out that you're literally a part of the gossip fodder for the beauty salon circuit. What was the low point?
Well, when my stepdad left the bank, that was definitely the low point, because we had the turnover of the management team in the fall after I got here. It was apparent that we weren't going to be able to escape the condition that we were in unless we had new leadership. And so I had been working kind of alongside with him for those first few months. And so when it became apparent that he wasn't going to be able to be part of this fight with us, that was really difficult. And I was living with him at the time. And, you know, here's someone that brought me in to help. And the things that I'm uncovering required me to be the only family member in the bank anymore. And so, you know, that's something that was definitely the low point.
Well, how did you know that things were finally beginning to turn around?
So we hired a new president and CEO at the end of that year. And when he came in, about 3 months into it, he threw up his hands and he's like, "Jill, what are we going to do? This is not getting any better. It's just everywhere we look, there's something else that's horrible." And I told him, I said, "Yeah, we keep on picking up the rocks and looking underneath them. And all I can tell you is that it's less stinky when we pick them up than what it's been in the past." You could see the incremental improvements and what we were uncovering. The condition of the bank was, everything becomes more of a ratio game whenever you're in a troubled condition. And so you can forecast where you're going to be, and you have all of these if-then scenarios of what your capital is going to look like, what your classification ratio is going to look like if this happened or if this tips the wrong way. And so, I felt like you had control over it. What I couldn't control is what I didn't know. And I think that was seeing that I felt like I was getting more control over the known problems of the bank, that's where I started feeling more hope. And that's what kind of kept us going, is that we started really getting more of a handle on it.
How did you become CEO?
Whenever we hired the president and CEO, I was kind of managing things without him there. And then when he came aboard, he was wonderful and still a great mentor to me. His name's D.H. Wyatt. He said, "I'll really focus on our customers outside the bank. So I'll be the goodwill ambassador with community relations and getting engaged with our customers, ensuring we can keep them, making them feel more comfortable. And then you just keep doing what you're doing inside the bank." And then when I would have a question about something, I could go to him, and instead of kind of being a lone wolf, he would really question me further to really kind of help mature ideas or investigations that I had. And so we were kind of working alongside each other in that way, kind of like a mom and dad, for lack of a better analogy. So he was kind of dad out engaging with the community, and I was mom inside. People were more scared of me and they were less scared of him. As we got recovered, we had the fastest recovery in the nation without adding capital. The big fear was that we'd have to have to raise capital. We don't have a wealthy shareholder base. And so our motivations, I think, during that time were maybe a little bit different. I was trying to keep the bank from being sold. And then he was at the point in the career where I think that he was considering a potential investment opportunity for him. But as we were seeing that we were going to be able to recover from this without having to raise capital, and we were having less problems, our jobs started overlapping quite a bit. He was wonderful in that he said, "Jill, this is really your family's legacy. You've really fought for this." He had an abundant amount of opportunities to go other places, and he's a great turnaround artist. And so he chose to move on while staying connected with me as a mentor. So really an amazing individual to be part of this journey with me.
So you had spent all this time as kind of a Ms. Inside while you had a Mr. Outside. And as you became CEO, you needed to transition and do a lot more externally, get more involved with the community, continue to be approachable. What was that learning process like for you?
I'm still learning about that process. I think my challenge more really was internally. The board, whenever they made the change and appointed me to the position, their resounding feedback to me was, you have got to become more approachable internally, because everyone was so scared of me at that time. And I mean, they called me Johnny Cash, the Undertaker, because I wore black all the time. I mean, I was all business and very serious. And so, you know, I Googled, like, how do you look more approachable? And that was to wear colors. So from that point on, every day I wore color, and they would give me feedback that you appear a little bit approachable. But at the same time, it was just such a wonderful luck that social media really came to be and started being more in the forefront right when this change was occurring for me. And I had started to engage via Twitter and on Facebook. I actually joined Twitter the same day that we were released from a written agreement, because I thought I can optimize my search engine result, because back then, our bank was the only metropolitan bank that was in trouble in Oklahoma. So the stories about us were very popular, and they were all pretty negative. So if you search for Citizens Bank of Edmond or even Bank Oklahoma, you would see stories that were negative about our bank. So initially I jumped into social media thinking maybe I could change those search engine results to be more favorable, not just about the negative things that were going on in the bank. But what I found was this great community, and that's really the community I started interacting with first virtually. And then I jumped into having lunches and then meeting each other at chamber events. And it really started changing public perception of me and the bank and our team. And I think created a really easy transition for me to start going outside the bank and having a persona that was different than kind of the Undertaker, and more being able to be that community banker that had inspired me, you know, decades ago.
Well, clearly you turned the corner. In 2012, you were named Community Banker of the Year by American Banker. You've become almost famous, I'd say, on social media, very active, hit way above your weight class of 250 million in assets. So what's your day-to-day life like now, and how's that different since you joined the bank to come in and solve a bunch of difficult problems?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate now to have developed a team around me that I trust. And we've gone from 125 employees to just 50. And so they're incredibly resourceful and smart and again, trustworthy, most of all, where they're able to take care of the day-to-day activities, where I used to have my hands in everything that was happening day-to-day. I can really back off from that now and rely upon the team to take care of the bank and, you know, and then me able to move into the position that you're supposed to be in as president and CEO, where you're executing the strategic vision of the board of directors and then providing that inspiration for us to have enough momentum to achieve that vision. And for us, it really motivates me. Our board has made a commitment that they want us to be around for the next 116 years and to have that vision to say, we want this bank to be Citizens Bank of Edmond 116 years from now. What decisions do we need to make now in order to keep us relevant and nimble and adaptive to change? And so I get to balance my day more. I certainly have some meetings, but I'm going out and ensuring that we have good relationships with our customers. I'm trying to stay engaged with the fintech community to hopefully achieve that relevancy that we're aspiring to maintain. And then reading a lot more than what I did previously whenever we were, in the worst of times. And whether that's just using social media and staying abreast of things there, or pulling things off the bookshelf and actually sitting down with a book. So for me right now, it's a lot more about engagement rather than the actual sitting down and doing 12 hours of intense work by myself. And I'm naturally an introvert, so I get attracted to that pretty easily. But I have been so inspired by being able to connect with others that have really upped my game and have upped the game of our bank. I think the experience of coming through kind of the darkness and the depths of hell as a team, because most of us on this team went through that together, is that we're very courageous for a bank our size. We don't mind and trying something new, and we vet things very well internally and with regulators to be able to do new things. And we're not intimidated to think that we can do something maybe a much bigger bank would do, or maybe someone that maybe even banks aren't doing.
Well, you talk about courage. So how do you encourage people to take more risk now that you're not in this troubled bank situation any longer?
For several years there, failure was not an option. I mean, if anyone say that this bank could fail, I would not be a very, I wouldn't give them a very nice response. But in banking, it can become where failure isn't an option for anything. And so you become exceptionally risk adverse because you never want to fail at something. And so we've really have made a concerted effort to make failure acceptable, that we can try things and we don't have to be perfect. And our experiments with that have been really engaging with the customer and helping them shape how we're doing things, what products we're developing, how we're interacting with them, and seeing that that vulnerability of saying we don't have it all figured out and putting it out there to our customers who have stuck with us, even though the bank was in very weak condition previously, and to see their willingness to try to help make us better and more relevant, showing that vulnerability with our team and them seeing me fail or try ideas that maybe aren't fully developed has allowed them, I think, to do that in their own areas.
Well, how do you want people to challenge you?
I love to be challenged from all different directions. You know, we have our most challenging customers are my favorite customers, the ones that want to give us feedback consistently and aggressively. And so I enjoy that transparency from customers. And even if it's public for other people to see, I used to be scared of that. And, you know, seeing someone give you a negative Facebook review or something negative on Twitter used to petrify me. And I think it does most bankers. But now seeing whenever you engage with someone when they're having complaints and how it can make you better and how it can actually elevate relationships with customers that were formerly your detractors and how those can become your strongest advocates, I really have valued that and really enjoy that as part of my professional life. And the same is true with our team members. Rather than having a really autocratic type of authoritative leadership style, which I did have our first few years here, being someone now that's more inclusive of ideas, trying to collaborate and lead things as a team rather than just as an individual, you know, that feedback and being challenged with my ideas and encouraging my team to come up with their own ideas to make things better. I think that's been a big transition for me and our bank, and has really allowed us to do things in our market and have a perception in our market that is far beyond what any one person could achieve if they were doing it on their own.
What's the role of fintech in your future?
Fintech is what's driving the change right now in our industry. And so for bankers, I think we're pedaling as hard as we can to kind of keep up with just the communications that are happening from the fintech community to know what products and services are available and be inspired by them. And we're also then, you know, have the technology infrastructure for community banks that's typically held by really relatively few. And they still make a lot of money doing their old way of doing things, particularly the cores. And they're resistant to change because they don't have this huge outcry to change. And so I utilize a lot of the contacts and communications from the fintech community to try to pressure some of those more the dinosaurs, for lack of a better word, to help them see the changes that are taking place and the threat and opportunity that's there for community banks, to hopefully inspire them to allow for integrations and opportunities to partner so that my bank and others can become more relevant and hopefully partner with fintech going forward.
So what's next for you? Anything in particular we should watch out for that's going to be coming out in the near future?
Oh, well, coming from us, you know, we don't have a team of developers being 50 people, so we have to rely upon partnerships primarily. But then we also think about fintech as not being necessarily code or hardware that's being deployed or apps, but rather that it can be a different way of interacting with a customer or different leveraging technology to be able to provide banking services in a different way or expand upon the services that we provide now. So one thing we're doing right now is collaborative office space, where we've transitioned a 12,000 square feet that used to be dedicated to a former branch to now being kind of a hotbed for entrepreneurs and technology companies. And so we're able to extend a lot of the technology that the bank has that we're already paying for in that infrastructure to now extend that to a wider group to be able to provide the benefit to our customers that need that type of space. And so whether like we offer secure Wi-Fi for our team members in our lobby, so we all use services and move around so that we're not, we have collaborative office space ourselves. So then we created really great Wi-Fi for our customers to use inside the bank. And we started seeing companies starting to form and meet in our bank lobby. And so creating a space for them and extending the Wi-Fi out to them. We have like in-bank kiosk for information about the community, information about banking, information about our customers, and extending that to this type of space. And then in addition to that, because of this really close relationship we have with our customers and this feedback they provide us, we are now opening up a personless branch, for lack of a better description, in downtown Oklahoma City, in which we're utilizing traditional bank technology, the ITM and, just a night drop for cash. But we're also developed some of our own technology to deploy in reaction to customer needs in that area, and where they can get roll coin access. And we had a difficult time finding where you can go and buy technology that will give you rolled coin on demand. And so we developed that ourselves. And we're also doing a cash exchanger, which I know when I worked at the Fed, currency was going to be dead, especially coin, in a matter of years. But there's a lot of businesses, bars, restaurants, coffee shops still use our high-end cash-intensive businesses. And so having a little cash hub there where they can come in the middle of the night and exchange ones to get ones and fives from their 20s, 50s, and 100s, all kind of using technology that's not necessarily in banking right now, but that we can get secured access via your phone to be able to get into the facility. And then we can use tracking software to be able to make sure that it's a customer that's in there based upon the app that they're using. And then we can deploy technology that's being used in some of the other industries to be able to give them the cash access.
Well, Jill Castilla, this has been great. Anything else you'd like to share before we close?
No, I mean, I just hope keep those ideas coming. And I love, JP, that you're so wonderful at highlighting what's happening in our industry and the movers and shakers that are creating those next ideas, and especially those ones that will stick. And that's what's going to allow bankers to connect with the fintech community, to hopefully keep this industry around for a really long time.
I'm JP Nichols. This has been the Serial Entrepreneur Podcast. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star rating. That really helps other people discover it. You can also learn more and support this and all the other great podcasts from Provoke Media at provoke.fm.